Welcome to episode 3 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Broadcast, brought to you by Steptoe and Johnson. Thanks for joining us. We're lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by some of our regulars, Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office, Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with the NSA and DHS, doing similar kinds of law practice here at Steptoe. We'll be joined, this is very exciting, our first extended interview will be joined by Chris Inglis, the very recently former Deputy Director of the National Security Agency, talking about some of the NSA issues that have come to the fore in the last 6 months. But let's get started with our rundown of the news, because there's been quite a bit of it. Let me start with a topic that enormous amounts of money and great corporate angst has been expended on, but which I'm really having trouble getting excited about or, frankly, even coming to fully understand the issues. And that is the Aereo case, the streaming TV with the little tiny antennas that has all the cable and broadcasters upset. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear that case. Mike, what's going on?
Well, Aereo is a company that takes broadcast television transmissions and then retransmits those broadcasts over the Internet to Aereo subscribers. Right now it operates in New York. I think it's still the only place. Might be one or two other places by now. But the way it operates is it sets up arrays of tiny dime-sized antennas, each of which is assigned to a particular subscriber. And the subscriber can then decide from any Internet-enabled device whether he or she wants to either watch live a particular broadcast TV show or record it for later viewing. Now, this is driving broadcasters nuts because they say this violates our copyrights in these broadcasts, and more importantly, it potentially completely destroys our business models, because why would anybody want to watch TV broadcast over the old-fashioned airwaves when they can watch it over the Internet, and, you know, it's going to destroy our advertising base, et cetera, et cetera. The Second Circuit ruled for Aereo, saying that this was not a copyright violation because it's not a public performance of the copyrighted material, because Aereo was not transmitting these broadcasts to the public. Essentially, it was transmitting the broadcast individually to each of the subscribers who decided whether he or she wanted to watch a broadcast. And this seems like a natural follow-on to the Cablevision decision earlier, which addressed a similar situation, which allowed people to use Cablevision's DVR to record cable transmissions. The copyright holders petitioned the Supreme Court for cert, and notably Aereo agreed that cert was appropriate because this was an issue of important public policy, and also I think because Aereo didn't want to continue to be dragged through multiple courts, sometimes winning, sometimes losing. So the court granted the petition. There have already been many amicus briefs filed, and this is going to be a real doozy, I think, when the court hears argument.
You know, it strikes me that was a very smart move. They knew this case was going to go to the Supreme Court, but there were splits all over the place. Why not take up a case that you won? The facts ought to be in better shape for them.
I think that's right. And, you know, there was a pretty strong dissent in the Second Circuit from Judge Chin. So, you know, I think both sides of the argument are very clearly and well laid out in the Second Circuit's opinions. And both sides are represented ably, so it's going to be very interesting to watch.
All right. And any idea what this means for ordinary people? Does it mean we get to watch the 49ers whenever we want to? Is that?
Yeah, potentially. And it could mean a lot of savings on your cable bill and other ways of viewing the TV shows. You know, I think a lot of companies have already said, look, if Aereo wins in the Supreme Court, we may just throw out our existing model and move to an Aereo-like system, because this is an easy way to save costs and cheapen the service for subscribers and make a lot of money for ourselves.
Well, it probably is inevitable that that's going to happen, but if you're in the business, you want to stave off the inevitable as long as possible. Let's move on to the NSA news. Since we last talked, the president has given his big speech on NSA. He's released a policy directive and a whole bunch of declassified information has come out as well. Overall, as I've had a chance to think about it, I live blogged it, but now that I've had gotten a bit of perspective and had a chance to read what Ben Wittes said and listen to what he said about it, I've come around to the view that it was, on the whole, for people who care about security, a pretty good speech and a pretty good outcome for NSA. It doesn't mean there aren't bad things in it, but first, as Ben Wittes pointed out, the president has an inclination to side with the libertarians, the civil libertarians, against his own government and his own policies, and to blame his policies on his predecessor. And he didn't really do that. He actually came out and said, no, we need this stuff. And on the whole, NSA has lived by the rules, and we can trust it with some tweaks. And he had a bunch of tweaks. Mike, what struck you about the president's speech? What worries you for the future, and what do you think was smart on the part of the president?
Well, I generally agree that this I see this as a pretty big win for NSA, because the potential changes were a lot more dramatic if the president had followed the recommendations of the review panel more closely. To me, the biggest change is with regard to the telephony metadata program under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. The president said from now on, NSA will have to get an order from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court anytime it wants to query that database. That's a pretty big change. But, you know, in 2012, NSA queried that database only 288 times, I believe, is the number. So if they can come up, if DOJ can work out a more expedited process for getting approvals from the FISA court, that may not be as big a deal as it seems. May not be as big an impediment. I think NSA can probably live with that, although I'm very curious to see what Chris has to say about that. And also, NSA will be restricted to in its contact chaining to only two hops away from a suspicious number. So that now it can look at, if it's got a suspicious number, it can look at what numbers that suspicious number was in contact with, and then what other numbers that first set of numbers is in contact with. It can't go a third level. So, you know, I'm not a mathematician, but that's a lot fewer numbers that they can look at. But again, you know, I think,
if I remember right, they didn't actually do that third hop always, and maybe not even most of the time. I got the sense that they looked out to the second hop to see if there was a pattern, and then if the pattern seemed to suggest there was somebody out at the edge who was really central to the group, they might ask, well, who else is he in contact with? But they didn't do that all the time.
Right, and they can always get an order. I mean, if they have enough predicate, they can always get an order to go to that third hop, I think. So, you know, I suspect NSA in the internal administration debate said that this was not going to be that big a problem. The president gave the Attorney General and the DNI until March 28th to come up with options for storing the metadata in the hands of someone other than the government. You know, the proposals were to have the providers store the information themselves, or to have some sort of third party hold it in escrow, which, you know, I don't know about you, but it gave me the shivers, because all I could think about was the key escrow proposals from the 90s.
Hey, those were my policies to defend.
You made it up, and then, you know, in the Clinton administration, I had to keep pushing it, but it was not well received broadly. But in any case, you know, I think they'll come back with a list of options, and I have to believe that ultimately the conclusion is going to be that nothing else is workable. Industry doesn't want to retain the data, although it's already retaining a lot of it for their own billing purposes. And the idea of setting up some third party is just not going to fly. It would create security risks and I think all sorts of legal headaches as well.
You know, I think that's right, but it's interesting. I just blogged this morning in response to something that Randy Barnett, who's a Georgetown law professor, said, where he said, this is completely unconstitutional, and you need to, you can't have the government hold this data. And that is a powerful legal argument, which is completely answered by putting it into an escrow. And so to the extent that the legal argument actually develops legs, I think this notion of a third party holding it, because I agree the telcos aren't going to want to do this, might end up having some force, not because it makes any policy sense, but because this rather dumb, in my view, legal argument about the importance of keeping it out of the hands of the government could get some support, especially if Smith against Maryland starts disappearing.
Yeah, that would certainly change the I think the calculus if that third party doctrine goes away. I tend to think that's unlikely, but that would certainly change a lot of things in the intelligence and law enforcement world.
No, that was my point. I said, you know, we've learned in the third grade that if you give somebody a secret, you should expect that it's going to be used in ways you didn't expect when you handed it over. And if we can learn that in the third grade, we ought to be able to apply it in interpreting the Constitution. Okay, so big losers out of this speech actually are the experts working group and the dozens of remarkable and intrusive structural proposals they made that just disappeared from view.
Yeah, I think one of the most important of those recommendations that was rejected was that the FISA court be responsible for approving national security letters, which are essentially in the intelligence world's version of grand jury subpoenas or administrative subpoenas, which the FBI can issue on its own authority. You know, they issue thousands, many thousands of these things a year. The FISA court, you know, in a letter to members of Congress said, we don't want the responsibility for doing these. You know, I personally had to sign a lot of these in the pre-9/11 days, and they would sit in my inbox literally stacked several feet high. Those stacks are a lot higher now, and the idea of having a court have to review each one of those things would have really markedly changed the way the FBI does business in this world.
That was always,
so I think that was pretty significant that they rejected that.
That was always the weirdest of the recommendations. It's like they said, we know you're mad at NSA. We'd like to take the FBI out in the courtyard and shoot them. It was just an odd set of recommendations. Okay.
Yeah, and it would have made them superfluous, too, because they would have been as hard to get as a 215 order, which makes no sense.
Yeah. So future of 215, seems to me the president signaled some flexibility without actually delivering more than the 2 points that you covered, and left it to Congress to work out the details, which I think is probably about right. He's could have given us a notional set of parameters that he's comfortable with, but this is something where Congress is going to have to come to its own resolution. They were never just going to accept what the president suggested, so it would be foolish for him to mark out territory very clearly. And my guess is what we get is a lot of thrashing all year and no real resolution, because it's an election year, and then all of these ideas come back in the beginning of 2015 with the deadline for sunset of the whole 215 program and the whole 215 provision, and then at some point in the last few, you know, in the middle of 2015, and then they have to come up with a solution, and in the hopes of getting 215 reauthorized, and they either succeed or they fail.
Yeah, I that's going to be the moment of truth, because the idea of having freestanding legislation to change the 215 program, get through both houses of Congress, and even more difficult than that is getting through the intelligence committees, where the chairs have said they're opposed to major changes, that's not going to happen. But 215 has to be reauthorized next year, and if there are not majorities in both houses, that's not going to happen. So that's when I think we could see changes if the uproar continues for another year.
Oh, I think that's not a certainty. Yeah, I think
it's not
that the uproar will continue, but we now have a substantial number of recently elected Republicans who've decided to get in touch with their inner civil libertarian, and they're going to stay opposed to this, and some of them are likely to get elected to the Senate. So we're going to have a pretty substantial resistance on the part of Republicans, and then you've got civil libertarian Democrats who are also skeptical about this. I think this is going to be a very near-run thing, right to the end, and it could fail.
I'll tell you one thing about the speech that surprised me and actually impressed me is we've talked before about how in the immediate aftermath of the Snowden leaks and the uproar in Europe, that the administration seemed to go into a fetal position.
Yeah.
And the speech reflected more backbone than I thought. That, you know, the president made the observation that the debate generated by Snowden's leaks has produced more heat than light, which I think is right. And he made the observation that we can't unilaterally disarm our intelligence services or be expected to do that. And he made the observation that we need to look beyond the drama of the last few months of headlines and take a longer view. So I thought it was a thoughtful attempt to balance the privacy issues that were really raised by the Snowden leaks with the need to national security, and it wasn't nearly as reactionary as I feared it would be.
In general, I would say about this president, he's at his worst when he's winging it. He's at his worst in his first reaction to things, and he's at his best when he has time to actually think, maybe play a round of golf, and come back with a position that reflects his having mulled it over, and we're lucky that he got that time to do this. So last point on this, the FISA, the judges, the Administrative Conference, the Judicial Conference, weighed in on this, really, with the FISA judges, and said a whole bunch of things that were kind of a surprise and are going to have some impact. I thought, in addition to saying we really don't want to do all these NSLs, they said, and please don't give us some massive machinery of advocacy to snipe at every single application that comes before us. I thought that was interesting. Is that going to change the likely outcome of this other, if I had to guess, it's the other significant FISA reform that's likely to get legs as a result of the Snowden discussion. Mike?
Yeah, this is an interesting letter from Judge Bates, who was formerly the chief judge of the FISA court and now is the judiciary's liaison regarding FISA matters. And you're right, you know, one of the recommendations from the review panel was that there be a privacy advocate who could decide which cases to get involved with that were coming up before the FISA court and just intervene, representing privacy interests in the abstract. And the FISA judges, or at least Judge Bates, speaking on behalf of some unknown group of judges, said we don't really want that. We want, you know, at most, we should have the ability to appoint an advocate to take that sort of perspective on things when we think it would be helpful to us. But we don't want to have anything crammed down our throats. And the president's statement about this left it somewhat vague about what exactly he envisions. He sees having a panel of privacy advocates who could intervene in significant cases. But who decides when they get involved and what? Who decides what's a significant case? We're left unclear and up in the air. So I think that's another one where we'll have to wait and see what the committees in Congress come up with on that.
Yeah, and again, more strategic ambiguity from the president in an area where he knows that being very specific would only make enemies on the Hill and make an agreement there a little harder to achieve. So smart politics, I think. So let's turn to another topic. $32 million is what it cost Apple in refunds because of a violation of because of allowing kids to make in-app purchases without parental consent. What's the story behind this, Jason?
Well, this is a story that resonated with me personally. I have young kids, at least one of whom's first word, I think, was in-app purchase. Apple agreed to pay $32 million, $32.5 million actually, in refunds for in-app purchases that were made without parental consent. And what the problem that the FTC challenged was that under Apple's operating system, if you entered the password to allow your child to make an in-app purchase, the password stayed valid for a 15-minute window, so the kid could make subsequent in-app purchases without the parent needing to enter the password subsequent times. And it resulted in some very large bills on iTunes for some parents. You know, I read one story that said that one parent owed $2,600 worth of in-app purchases for an app that her child, her daughter had made. And there were millions and millions of dollars owed by tens of thousands of customers who had been victimized by this 15-minute window of authorization that they didn't know was open for longer than 15 seconds. So Apple has agreed to refund the money that those customers paid and to change the way the system works so that each purchase requires a separate entry of the password. And the FTC also complained that Apple had actually failed to make clear to parents when they were entering the password in the first place that that was authorizing a purchase. When your kid comes to you with the iPhone or iPad and says, could you enter your password, that's a pretty good sign that they're asking you to spend money. So by the end of March, Apple has to institute changes that will require express consent each time. And the $32.5 million is a fund that's created that's the minimum amount that Apple has to pay in refunds. If they, within 12 months, have not actually paid that much in refunds, the rest reverts to the FTC. And I think this sort of combines two of the FTC's strong interests. One is mobile privacy and the mobile payment system. The other is getting funded, I guess three. And the other is dealing with issues involving parental consent and protection of online privacy of children. And I guess the third is increasing their budget. So for anybody who markets apps to kids or who markets apps of general application that they know are used by kids, it's a cautionary tale to make sure that you have tight restrictions on the way in-app purchases are handled.
Okay, yeah. So let's turn to actually a piece of good news on the cybersecurity front, at least I think it is. NIST has not quite released the final cybersecurity framework, but they've said that they'll get it out by the middle of February. More significantly, they've announced that they're going to reduce what I call the privacy tax on cybersecurity. NIST had written some plausible, though very procedural, cybersecurity rules for their framework, and they got a generally good reaction. But then they've written some very prescriptive and costly and lawyer-heavy rules about privacy, so that when you decided to do anything in cybersecurity, you had to minimize privacy impact and avoid collecting information and a variety of things that seem to say whatever you do, you've got to be giving preference to privacy over your cybersecurity mission. And to their credit, they listen to that criticism and Harriet Pearson got together a group and wrote an alternative set of standards that you could fit on half a page that simply says you need procedures, you need a plan for privacy, you need to protect private information that you have a legal obligation to protect, and do that when you engage in cybersecurity. A much more doable, much more reasonable and much more consistent with the overall standards for cybersecurity that NIST is working on. So it looks as though what NIST comes out with is going to become a procedural standard that most people can live with, that will have some privacy protections but nothing overdone. I wouldn't be surprised to see the president, the agencies that are responsible for this, begin to incorporate this into their regulations, into contracts and the like. And of course, for everybody, if the government comes up with a standard, you don't follow it and you have a security breach that results in harm to people, it seems to me that the courts are going to say, gee, we know what a reasonable person would do. The reasonable person would have followed this set of standards that the government has recommended to everybody in critical infrastructure. So for pretty much the entire country, this will become an important reference guide, and I'm glad they fixed the privacy issue. And with me, we'll get Adam Sedgwick to come be our second or third interviewee when the standard comes out. Any thoughts, Mike, Jason? Nope. Okay, so to close off, before we get to Chris, let me ask about an area that combines the NSA issue with U.S.-EU trade talks. One of the things that President said he was going to do and did in the presidential directive was to say that he's going to treat the privacy rights of foreign nationals in many ways similarly to the privacy rights of Americans. And he wrote a set of principles that are now part of the presidential directive. The European Union, which of course has no authority over anybody's intelligence services, nonetheless announced immediately that it was planning to try to nail down all of these in some kind of negotiation with the United States, and that it was holding the, as I read it, the safe harbor hostage to try to get an agreement that would allow it, if it couldn't supervise its own intelligence services, at least to supervise ours. This issue is caught up in some ways in trade talks and in some ways not. Jason, what's going on there?
Well, I think it's sort of a third frontier of hypocrisy that we've seen come out of Europe in the wake of Snowden. You know, the first, as we've written about in our blog, is the fact that the countries in the European Union have comparable, if not greater, access to their citizens' data for law enforcement and national security purposes without any judicial authorization or oversight like we have here. The second frontier is that their own countries' intelligence services, who have been remarkably silent in the wake of Snowden, engage in similar activities, and they, of course, benefit from the information that our intelligence services have been able to collect to prevent terrorist attacks on their own soil. And now we have this, which is attempting to use the NSA issue as a wedge in trade talks, but really talking out of both sides of their mouth, because they very much want, as you suggested, to make our government's access to data a trade issue while keeping their government's access to data completely separated from the trade talks. As you mentioned, the president's proposal to treat non-U.S. citizens with privacy, to protect their privacy rights in a way that's similar to Americans, I think will potentially dial down some of the rhetoric here. I think also the president also, although he didn't refer to it by name, he has effectively advocated for reform of the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty process, which governs the conditions under which governments can get data for law enforcement and security purposes that's stored in other countries. And he indicated that he would be putting additional resources behind reform of that process. I think that also will help on the trade front. But I think that it's probably not also a coincidence that just yesterday the FTC announced settlements with about a dozen U.S. companies for falsely claiming to abide by the safe harbor. It's one of the criticisms that that you hear from the EU is that there is weak enforcement of the safe harbor and that there's not a strong privacy enforcement generally in the United States. And so the FTC has been eagerly trying to demonstrate to a worldwide audience that it's an aggressive privacy enforcer. Certainly the Europeans could just come ask any one of the 50 companies the FTC has come after here.
I think we should trade. We'll take the Canil for 6 months.
Right.
And
right.
The French like, can have the,
right,
FTC,
the FTC
and see how they like it.
Right, we'll see how quickly they want to give us back the FTC. But, you know, Google and the FTC points to their enforcement actions against Google and Facebook and Microsoft. And as I said, yesterday they announced enforcement actions against 12 companies for falsely claiming they're abiding by the safe harbor. And I think there's a real effort to demonstrate that we take safe harbor enforcement seriously, we meaning the United States government, and an effort by the president to sort of dial down, as I said, dial down the rhetoric, and to calm fears among Europeans that they need to use the safe harbor negotiations as a vehicle to try to control what the U.S. government does. The reality is, as we talked about before and written about, much of this is cynical. You know, there are some EU officials who are motivated by the view that privacy is a fundamental right that needs to be protected. There are some EU officials who are motivated by dollars and the fact that this is what I think you've called information protectionism, that they're using this cynically to create or to increase a market advantage for European providers over American providers by fomenting fear on the part of European consumers and businesses that they need to use European cloud providers and European internet providers because you can't trust the U.S. providers because the U.S. government can get whatever it wants whenever it wants, which, of course, is just not true.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how this plays out. The European Union has done this several times. One of the sort of hidden aspects of this is that there's a doctrine in Europe that says if we open negotiations with foreign governments on a topic, no one inside Europe is allowed to get out of line with us and our policies. So just by opening negotiations with us on intelligence, I think it gives them some ability to influence intelligence policy. And then, of course, if they sign this, they can sign up to mutual obligations, which they can then enforce on the foreign intelligence services they otherwise have no authority over. So it's an enormous turf enhancer for Brussels, which is why they keep wanting to do this and why we're very foolish to fall for it time and time again, which we have done. So hopefully, having been beaten up in both the SWIFT negotiations and the PNR negotiations, the third time the U.S. government learns its lesson.
Well, I'm hopeful that the same, we talked before about the backbone reflected in the president's speech. I'm hopeful that that same backbone will be a part of the negotiation of safe harbor. And the fact that the president's proposed to treat non-Americans essentially the same way as Americans when it comes to privacy, and the fact that there will be apparently a genuine effort to put real money and energy behind MLAT reform, and the fact that the FTC has a good story to tell about safe harbor enforcement, I think will hopefully we will not roll over, and there will be a genuine effort to protect safe harbor.
Well, and it would be great if we said, you're only going to get MLAT reform if you knock this stupid stuff off, or we'll give MLAT to the cooperative governments who aren't jerking us around and not to the ones who are jerking us around. That would shape everybody up pretty fast, I think. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Jason. I'm going to turn now to Chris Inglis, who's had a remarkably distinguished career at NSA, rising to the highest position you can as a career member of NSA's senior staff, and who has left the agency within the last month or so. So he's both fresh and willing to talk. Chris, I should say, I tell everybody who's left government, the good news is you can say what you want. The bad news is you can say what you want because nobody cares. In fact, everybody will be very interested in hearing what you have to say. I recognize that you aren't going to be able to say anything that includes classified information. You're bound for life by all of those restrictions. But with that, let me welcome you to the podcast and start with the first question. And I say this as somebody who lived at NSA for several years. What has this been like for the agency? What's the effect on morale? And do you think that it's going to be a
permanent effect.
Yeah, so thanks, Stuart. It is a pleasure to be here. And of your 2 points about what retired service is like, I'm absolutely certain of the first, which is that I'm kind of free to say what I might, hopefully responsibly. And let's test the second as to whether anyone's interested in that. As to what this has been like for NSA or people who work at NSA, I'll give you two perspectives. The first is that for people who show up there, who don't show up for the swell parking, for people who show up because they think they're making a difference for something larger than themselves, the events of June and the following months were shocking. Because NSA was essentially being called out as having done something that was either inappropriate or illegal or both. And what NSA, in my view, is obsessed with compliance not simply with the letter of the law, but with the spirit of the law. And so for Mr. Snowden and then others to join that bandwagon and to call that into question, that had a very, very serious effect on the workforce. And yet they held firm, being the kind of workforce that they are, they looked first into themselves to determine whether or not these things were true, determining that they were not true and understanding that they still make the contribution that matters, they held firm. Attrition ticked up in a couple of areas where our workforce is hugely sought after, some of those high-end technical areas, but nothing egregious. And across the board for the last 7 months, attrition has been as low, relatively low, as it's been for years, in the neighborhood of 3.5-4% for a workforce whose demographics would argue that perhaps it should be 5-7%. And the steady inquiry of people who want to come to work at NSA has also held firm. More importantly, having kind of withstood the 7 months of questioning and some kind of external set of doubts hurled our way, we were greatly relieved by the president's speech, which I thought was a very thoughtful threading of the needle, trying to reconcile any number of issues. And I wouldn't say so much that it vindicated NSA, because NSA does not have interests that are distinguished, equities distinguished from the nation, but it affirmed NSA. It affirmed that NSA had done essentially the government's bidding, that it had been no finding that NSA had exceeded its boundaries, and that what's at issue here isn't so much to restrain NSA to something that it should have been restrained to in the first place, but rather questioning the policy itself as to whether the government will employ NSA and other instruments in different ways. So when it's all said and done, I think the people at NSA are going to hold firm. I think they'll be fine. I think that at the end of the day, when this is all judged in years' time as opposed to weeks' time, we'll find that the momentum through the middle, the inertia, a good inertia, stood us in good stead.
So I think that sounds about right. That I think it was a shock for the agency to be told, yeah, maybe you thought you were behaving legally, but we all hate you, and we're going to find a way to make it illegal. But a lot of that talk has died down a bit, and I think the president's defense of the agency is important. In terms of what the president said he wanted to change, is there? We can talk about some specifics, but is there anything that you think is going to be particularly difficult for NSA to implement or risky for the signals intelligence enterprise?
Nothing impossible. At the end of the day, we're balancing various aspects of what the nation cares about. So balance the risk that we'll miss something in terms of catching an act or an intent to commit an act that would hold the nation at risk. Balance that with the need to ensure that we've taken all the necessary precautions to protect privacy. Not just of U.S. persons, but of innocents of any nationality. And that's the balance that we continue to try to strike. It's not a new balance. It's not something that is a new issue for NSA, but that's what we're going to try to do. With respect to the 215 program itself, the collection of metadata, which came in for a lot of time and attention over the last 7 months, and certainly in the president's speech, and I think first and foremost we need to remember that it was narrowly framed to achieve one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to cover the seam between a foreign terrorist organization and its attempt to execute a terrorist attack on U.S. soil. The events of 9/11 showed us that that scene was not well covered, that we were able to track foreign terrorist organizations abroad. And similarly, we were able to do things domestically, but we weren't connecting those two worlds. And that NSA itself had essentially collected a conversation overseas without knowing that there was a U.S. end to that. And the view that it had on that conversation was essentially a one-ended call. It's the nature of telecommunications. We could only see the data associated with one end of that call. We had no idea where the other was. And so without a way to test the theory that that had a nexus in the United States, we certainly did not test the theory, and we missed it. Whether this program would have guaranteed us catching that or not, I don't know. But the program is designed to do just that, very narrowly framed. And in so doing, it's designed to achieve four things. The first is privacy protections, the way the data is held, the way the controls are designed, the primary order of the court. Mr. Snowden was careful to release only the secondary order, which talked about the collection of data. He ignored the fact that there's a much longer order that talked about the controls imposed on the use of the data.
Yeah, I think they actively suppressed that for about 2 weeks in the hopes of nailing the narrative to a particular train, and they succeeded. They only brought out the minimization order when they could claim that it was contradicting something the government was saying.
That's true. And so I, you know, take it that Mr. Snowden and some of his strongest supporters have been singularly skewed in the release of this data to favor a particular bias that they might enjoy. The other three properties have to do with then the use of that data. One, it has to have sufficient depth, meaning it goes back in time. That if you're looking for a plot that goes back months or years, you want to have some confidence that if you query that database that you'll see it. Or that if you query the database and nothing comes back, that you can have confidence that it's not there. It has to have breadth, meaning it needs to cover a sufficiently broad spectrum of telecommunications providers, such that, again, if you query the database and you get an answer, you can have some confidence that it's a comprehensive answer. And if nothing is returned from that query, you can have some confidence you didn't miss it because the data wasn't there. It wasn't there in the first place. And then finally, it's got to have sufficient agility in order to stay abreast of plots that emerge at speed, at least at human speed, if not at net speed. And so if it takes you 5-6 days to get a response to that query, but what you're trying to determine is a plot that might be fomented in the next 10 to 12 hours, that's not going to meet the agility requirement. Of all the changes that the president has proposed, that's perhaps the one that's at greatest risk. If the court imposes some secondary consideration before the database can be queried, you're probably going to run the risk of not being agile enough. I believe that the president intended and that there should be an exigent circumstances provision that says in an emergency that you can essentially have permission to query the data and then achieve permission from the court in arrears and be held accountable if perhaps you've not made the proper use of that authority. So when it's all said and done, those four criteria can be satisfied using different implementations. I would hasten to note that over the 12 years that this program has largely been kind of developed and kind of to which we arrive at its current formulation, we've benefited from any number of implementations and have settled on this one through a series of evolutionary steps, not by accident, and not because all the others were unavailable to us, but because this seemed to be a good composition, a good reconciliation of the competing factors that are at issue here. Narrowly focused on a single purpose.
What I didn't hear you say is this wouldn't work if it were in the hands of a third party. It might not work very well if we're in the hands of a whole bunch of different telcos with different systems, but if there were, if they found a non-profit that would take the data from the different telcos, put it into a standard format so it could be searched in an efficient way, but wasn't in the hands of the government, would that work?
Yeah, technically, that could work. It would likely require some statutory changes. I don't know that you're going to be able to compel the providers, the telecommunications providers, to turn that data over to a third party without providing some legal basis for that. It probably exceeds the executive branch's authority, inherent authority. you're likely to make it more expensive to essentially take that data now and transfer it over to a third party who now has to create the architecture, create the privacy controls, create a cadre of people who can manage that data. But all of those are secondary to the primary purpose of the program and to the four criterion. Can you protect privacy? Does it have sufficient depth and breadth? And can it be agile enough? You can achieve those in any number of implementations. That could be one.
So what's your guess about, you had to watch Congress dealing with this program. If the sunset were tomorrow and the vote were tomorrow afternoon on whether to continue 215, do you think it would continue?
I do think it would continue. I think that there would likely be some imposition of additional constraints. Perhaps they would second the president's motion that we go from three hops to two hops. Maybe they would constrain the length of time that the data could be held. Perhaps they would introduce in legislation a role for the court in much the same way that the president has through executive order. But I don't think that the Congress would walk away from a tool that is uniquely designed for covering of that scene, looking for terrorist plots across from the foreign to the domestic domain. Because while other things might catch that, nothing has the ability to guarantee that you would catch that.
Yeah, I think that probably is going to be the toughest question for people who oppose this to answer, which is really what are you proposing we do to make sure that it doesn't happen to us again? It's a compelling question, and bringing all of these alternatives to bear in 2015 really makes that a tougher vote than a yes/no on 215. So it'll be interesting to see how it comes out. Let me turn to a topic that in the president's speech that really bothered me, and his policy directive, but maybe bothers you a little less, which is the idea that we're going to not gather intelligence for purposes of disadvantaging people based on their ethnicity or their religion, that we're going to treat for minimization purposes and retention purposes foreign nationals the same as Americans. The first one strikes me as implausible if it says what it seems to say, which is that, you know, we won't actually be looking at people because of their religion, even if they say that, you know, their religion requires them to kill Americans. Having gone back to read that language, I realize there's a lot of room in the joints for the president or for the NSA to say, we're not doing this for the purpose of harming them due to their religion. We're doing this for the purpose of gathering foreign intelligence. And I assume that's a way it'll be interpreted. But the provisions that say we should treat Americans the same as foreigners for purposes of minimization struck me as harder to work with, because at least when I was at NSA, when we sent something around that had a U.S. person's name in it, it was a big deal. We took out the name, we put in U.S. person one. Anybody who wanted to know that name had to say, I need this because otherwise I won't understand the foreign intelligence significance of it. We kept lists of everybody who asked for the names to make sure that if they abused that information, we could hold them responsible. Doing that every time we mention Osama bin Laden is kind of burdensome and a little silly. And so I'm wondering how you think that'll actually work in practice.
I mean, I think in practice that it will largely follow through on a philosophy, a principle that's been there all along. The Europeans have codified in a nice way how they think about the balance between security and the defense of privacy. They talk about the need for necessity and the need for proportionality in the exercise of that necessity. NSA has followed much the same practice, though it's not codified in our authorities and laws in that way. There has to be a national security purpose. We don't simply investigate the communications of U.S. or foreign persons simply because we might find them interesting or because that we want to dibble around to see if we can't turn up some national security threat, we actually have to have some sense of necessity, and we have to do that in some proportionate way to that necessity. So extending what you now codifies, the president now codifies as the protection for ethnicity, religious, the prohibition against doing commercial intelligence, largely extends practices that are in place already, and so I'm not discomforted by that in any way, shape, or form. U.S. persons, which are more than U.S. citizens, have an inviolate protection under the Fourth Amendment to unreasonable search and seizure, and I think that what the president's likely talking about is to extend that in a reasonable way to foreign persons. Of note, you may have heard that there are about a dozen cases where individuals have misused SIGINT capabilities over the last 10 years. The majority of those cases were cases where an individual who was authorized to collect and look at the result of that collection using the SIGINT system misapplied it to a foreign person. And those were abuses that were serious enough for us, any misuse of the SIGINT system, that we stepped in, took action, removed the clearances of those persons. The ones who were military were reduced in grade, rank, lost pay. But very serious consequences to those individuals for the use of the SIGINT system against foreign persons. And so this is not anathema to us. It's actually consistent with practice. The devil will be in the details. Does the president mean that they will be treated identically to U.S. citizens? I don't think that's what he means. I think that we can get to some reasonable approximation of what that means. And people, no matter what their nationality, need to know that the SIGINT system, the U.S. SIGINT system, will not be used in an abusive way.
So that's very interesting. I hadn't thought about the dozen cases of actual misuse, but to be able to say that NSA has actually been disciplining Americans for intruding improperly on the privacy of foreign nationals for a decade or more is an appropriate and compelling talking point. I think that's my last question on that topic is the EU is going to show up with their band of negotiators ready to write all this down and demand the clearances so they can verify enforcement of the rules. Do you think that the intelligence community will have the backbone to say, sorry, we aren't talking to you about this issue?
I think the intelligence community is not a policy organ, and so we essentially effect the policies derived from the authorities of our government. And so for us, we'll be subject matter experts, but not to dodge the question. I think the really interesting question to pose to the European Union is, where do their member states come down on this? If their member states sign up to this, the member states are where the competence is held on matters of intelligence. Then the U.S. Can look at that to determine whether those principles reasonably convey to the execution of our own intelligence activities. My sense is that the U.S. is ahead of most of the European nations with respect to exercising three branch of government. Not everybody has three branches of government, but multiple branch of government oversight and control of intelligence authorities, not just for national purposes, but for the benefit of the coalitions, the alliances that they're aligned with. There's a great paper that came out even before the Snowden revelations, the unauthorized disclosures written by Hogan Lovell, I think it was about the May timeframe, that actually looked at the various systems that were in place to govern what we might describe as a lawful intercept. And it came away with the conclusion that the U.S. was far and away out ahead of the others. We'd be happy for there to be some reconciliation of the others to the United States. It strikes me that many of them will have to catch up to us, and so I'd like to see that this is fairly applied, not just to the United States, but to all members.
Yeah, no, I think maybe what we should do is we should say you can't export data to the European Union until they match our standards.
That's right.
No, sorry, that's a joke. I think a position where the government says, you see what we've said. When your member states say the same thing in an enforceable fashion, then maybe we can talk about getting together and coming up with standards that we can try to exhort the rest of the world to match. But please don't come prematurely asking for additional assurances from us when you haven't even matched what we've done. Now, it would be interesting. That's a fair negotiating posture, though it will drive the Europeans crazy. Let me ask about Snowden and two kinds of questions. One, how bad is the impact, and are there any particular compromises that you can point to without compromising classified information yourself that you think are obvious and troubling? And there's been a lot of talk recently, suspicion from the heads of the intelligence committees saying, you know, we think Snowden had help. Maybe he had help from the Russians. He gathered so much military information that had nothing to do with the scandals that he claims he wants to expose that it looks to us as though somebody gave him a shopping list. Can you talk about those two questions?
Yeah, on the first one, what I found interesting, continue to find interesting with Mr. Snowden is that his declared intent was to expose abuses, excesses by the National Security Agency with respect to the incursion into the privacy of U.S. persons, U.S. citizens. That's been found to be an argument that is without merit, without basis, despite the fact that we're, as a nation, reconsidering the policy of how we employ an NSA. The President quite succinctly stated right up front in the speech that there have been no excesses. There has been nothing that exceeded what three branches of government have put in place. And despite the fact that Mr. Snowden had kind of said that that was his cause, he has recklessly, in my view, released information well in excess of the information necessary to try to make his case. Catalogs of tools, all sorts of information about how we might find and hold at risk the communications of true adversaries, terrorists, rogue nations, cyber actors, potentially doing great harm to the common place we know as cyberspace. And I'm hard-pressed to understand, even from Snowden's perspective, how that makes sense. That reckless exposure of all of those sources and methods has certainly called into question on the minds of a lot of people who have perhaps confused the tools with the authorities and priorities of NSA as to whether NSA should be constrained, controlled in some way, shape, or form. We're spending a lot of excess energy trying to make the case that NSA is well-controlled and well-focused on the things that it should be and nothing more. The exposure of those tools and therefore the adversary's ability to avoid the use of those tools has caused a significant expense on NSA's part to try to figure out how to update those tools or to come up with new ways of finding and holding at risk adversary communications in the world.
Is this the thing?
And then finally,
the ANT catalog that we're talking about here?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Frankly, I can't see any merit whatsoever to the release of those. Unless, of course, your premise is that those are used without regard to whether or not NSA enjoys the authority or has the priority to target something of interest.
A couple of thoughts. He claims that the sort of intelligence gathering he wants is focused on individuals up close, but most of these tools do exactly that, allow you to focus on people individually, and yet he goes out and recklessly exposes them. And worse, this is a proof of concept for all kinds of things that I'm willing to bet that a lot of authoritarian governments with money but not much technical expertise didn't even know was possible. And now that they know it's possible, I guarantee that they've told their military, go out and get one of everything that's in this catalog. And so he has single-handedly guaranteed a major increase in the capabilities of authoritarian governments around the world with this release. It's just astonishing.
Yeah, and the last 7 months has made it very clear that the United States does and intends to sustain a regime of very tight control over activities like NSA. And speaking as a long-standing NSA employee, I welcome that. Right? I want to live in a nation where we exercise that sort of discipline. But to your point, most other nations don't exercise that kind of discipline, and certainly the sorts of nations that are kind of paying rapt attention to this, who are rogue nations or who constitute real and material threat to the United States and the world, will take ruthless advantage of what Mr. Snowden has laid on the table for them. With respect to complicity by the Russian or Chinese or other services with Mr. Snowden in his early days, I've seen no evidence of that. You have to wonder about the curious route that he took, first to Hong Kong, then to Moscow, as to whether there was, you know, anything that biased that, given a prior relationship. But there's no evidence, no proof of that. What I can say with some certainty is that it would be almost beyond imagination for the Russian intelligence services, who are quite good, to fail to take advantage of Mr. Snowden's presence in their country. Even if it's unwitting, you should know that they would do everything in their power to try and wrest whatever secrets he has from his grasp. He might be clever enough to have stolen them. It's going to be very, very hard for him to sustain the secret associated with them if there are any secrets that remain. And those services have shown themselves to be quite capable to not simply understand what those secrets are, but to employ them in ways that won't be to our advantage.
So that's very interesting. Let me just close with a question about the future of NSA, because this crisis for the agency, even though it looks as though it's going to survive it, reminds me, it's the first big crisis since the Church Committee, but it's a very different one because at the end of the day, the NSA was obeying the law, and for 40 years, NSA's rule of thumb was, we obey the law, and then we go out and grab signals intelligence in the most aggressive, creative, innovative, breathtaking way we can, and we bring back great stuff. And now, for the first time, we've got people who seem to be saying, well, maybe you shouldn't be quite so aggressive. Maybe you took too many risks. Maybe you didn't really need Angela Merkel's phone calls. So it's a different kind of crisis. It's a crisis of politics and discretion. And it feels more like the crises the CIA has gone through every 10 years, where first they get aggressive and then they discover that they've got bad people whom they're paying as sources, well, because the good people don't know anything about what bad people are doing. And they get beaten up for that, then they pull back, and then, you know, 5 years later, people are complaining that they're risk-averse. And that seems to me that NSA is likely to have to develop more political sense about its current status and how aggressive it should be. And it's going to need a whole cadre of people who can go out and talk about the agency in the way that CIA folks do, keeping the secrets that matter and yet talking in the way that you have about the agency to many different audiences, so that they don't have an on-off switch. Either I'm able to tell the people I'm talking to everything or nothing. They have to walk a closer line, a more narrow line. Do you think the agency is ready for that, and what does it need to do to get ready for that kind of world?
I think it has to be. I agree with you that this is not, doesn't bear much in the way of an analog to the Church Committee proceedings and the lessons of that. It's more like the late 1920s, with the then Secretary of State said that gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail, and largely disbanded what were nascent SIGINT efforts in those days. They continued on in the various military departments, but they were largely disbanded for the 1930s. And I think that the lesson of World War II for this nation was that we need to have a constant eye on threats to the nation such that we don't react as well to them as we anticipate them and steer the nation clear of them. I think that's got to be then the central purpose of foreign intelligence organizations within the United States. And so what we'll have to make sure we have is a pretty good script, and one that is kind of born not just of intellect but of heart. It talks about purpose, authority, priority, constraints, and ethos of intelligence organizations like NSA. We'll have to have a cadre of people who can speak to that. I think you develop that in multiple ways. One, you need to make sure that your senior leaders are more available, more exposed. I think it would have been beyond thinking for someone to be on a podcast of this sort a year ago, let alone 10 years ago, despite the fact that I'm only kind of recently removed from being the deputy director of NSA. Even that would have been hard to imagine. Two, I think we need to make sure that we're much more attentive to the need to be transparent. And so we're going to rebalance the kind of balance between secrecy and transparency while holding firm on valuing kind of security and privacy, security and civil liberties in equal measure. And so we'll put out a lot more information about perhaps generic capabilities, generic authorities, without disclosing the fine-grained details that get us into trouble because our adversaries take immediate advantage of those. We'll have to train our people from an earlier day to be comfortable with that, and so probably more out-of-the-building tours, more mid-career hires. NSA civilians typically come in at a fairly young age, stay for 10 to 40 years. It's not unlikely that people have 50, 60 years' worth of experience. But we'll have to have a somewhat more diverse range of skills and our ability to speak to the public, and we'll get that in all the traditional ways. When it's all said and done, though, the central purpose of NSA cannot change if it means to be successful, which is it has to develop deep expertise in the cryptologic disciplines, which requires us to hire people and have them dwell on things like mathematics, computer science, electrical engineering, arcane languages. So we need to make sure we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater as we try to adjust to modern times.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, no matter what adjustments you make on the transparency, those are valuable, and the NSA is clearly going to have to do it. But what really protects the agency, and really what protects the CIA, is NSA produces great, timely intelligence that the president and the national security establishment cannot imagine doing without. And as long as that's true, they will protect NSA's essential capabilities out of self-interest and not because they like the people that are there. And that's the fundamental protection that the agency has.
Yeah, I agree with that, but we need to make sure that we're very careful not to view that as something that would sustain us at all cost. So, you know, we take some pains to actually in-brief our civilians. The military are typically in-briefed in a slightly different way, but they get the same story. We kind of give them a sense of the history by taking them literally to our museum. We then talk about the oath that they're about to take to the Constitution. We're very clear that that's not an oath to the director of NSA, to the deputy director of NSA, whatever senior might be there, and that therefore is something more fundamental in terms of what they're signing up to. And then tell them this, that having taken that oath, that's their first and foremost obligation to support and defend the Constitution. But in order to be successful in this mission, this unforgiving mission where technology is always roiling away from us, adversaries are always maneuvering away from us, they have to do what we call principled audacity. They have to be audacious enough to exceed the expectations of those adversaries, to exceed the expectation of technologists as they devise the various methods by which these communications might be held away from us or obscured from us, but to do it always in a principled way. Those are not strange bedfellows. Those are necessary bedfellows. If we're ever caught kind of using expedient methods to get to the outcome of keeping the nation safe, that we sacrifice civil liberties in the name of security, we'll be in a real difficult place. I think that was the question of 2013. I think that we were kind of found to be in the right place, that we give sway to both of those. We have fealty to both of those characteristics, but we can never lose sight of that.
Yeah, well, it would be an irony, but not an unlikely irony, if the result of all of Snowden's disclosures is a national security agency that is actually stronger and more flexible and more sensibly audacious than in the past. And I certainly hope we end up there. Chris, thank you so much for doing this. It was a remarkably insightful discussion. I certainly learned a lot. What are you doing next, apart from catching up on your sleep?
A little bit of that. The nature of these jobs are that you run very hard for a period of time. In my case, I was in this job for 7.5 years. So you have very little time to actually think outside of that that set of that capacity. And so I'm just going to survey the landscape, take a broad look at what further possibilities there might be for me, kind of having grown accustomed to doing things that have some moral purpose attendant to them. I'm looking for things of that sort and will likely be driven to something that continues to let me feel like I'm part of something bigger than myself.
Well, we will be delighted to hear what you finally settle on and stay in touch. And when you do it, come back and let's talk about it again. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Stuart.
All right. This has been Episode 3 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Broadcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. I want to thank Michael Vadas, Jason Weinstein, and Chris Inglis, our special guest. Join us next week for insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government. And for more information, please visit our website at www.steptocyberblog.com. Thank you very much.